All right, everyone. Thank you for joining us. Please help me welcome Mark Edwards for our second series in Faith and Technology. Today, he'll be telling us about machines, cyborgs, and the meaning of humanity.
Now I'm turned on. There's a lot to talk about today. I don't imagine we can do it all. I'll try, but we probably won't succeed. The second topic that I wanted to put on the table is this discussion about robots and what they are and artificial intelligence and what will be possible and some of the dreams and maybe some of the dystopias. It's a huge subject. It's got a long history in literature, of course, and in film. For my money, one of the greatest insights and books to read is Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. Just outrageously insightful, creator and created in conversation and struggle. And that book has been meaningful and influential in different epochs and ought to be again. So I don't make mention of it, but I do put that at the front just to say that is worth engaging. It says it's on, but maybe do I need to move it up? Are we on? Okay. Here's a question just to get us started. It's speaking economically. What is a country's greatest resource? Water. I heard oil. People. Countries with the most water are the richest. Countries with the most oil are the richest. Countries with the most people are the wealthiest. Is any one of those obviously true? China and India have the most people, but aren't at the top in terms of economic wealth and development.
Well, the biggest economy is the U.S. economy, and it has neither the most fresh water.
Okay, so America's got the biggest economy. It doesn't have the most oil. It doesn't have the most people. It doesn't have the most water or gold or coal or trees. What does it have? What is Israel and Japan? What's driving their economies, even though they're smaller countries with not a lot of traditionally considered natural resources on site?
Discipline?
Technology? So the argument that I would propose is that a country's greatest natural resource isn't any material thing. It's not trees, it's not gold, it's not diamonds. In fact, economists talk about a resource curse. In some ways, it's bad to grow up in a diamond country. It's bad to grow up in a coal mining town. You're not gonna be as advanced if everything around you is oil extraction. The greatest natural resource is intelligence. It's countries that can develop the intelligence of their people that do the best. They can create wealth. They can create things of value. Infrastructure, healthcare, education, these are what contribute in the greatest effect towards a country's well-being over and against diamond mines, trees, oil fields. Intelligence, of course, takes sludgy mud in the dirt and turns it into a useful source of energy for an internal combustion engine. Without intelligence, oil isn't really worth much. It's intelligence that takes... What's driving this machine?
Electricity
running through what kind of chip? Silicon, right? Silicon's found where? Sand. Intelligence takes sand, grains of sand, and creates the greatest wealth-generating industry, machine, that the history of the world has ever known. Silicon is sand. So if intelligence, if wealth and isn't generated by sheerly material things, but is generated through intelligence using creativity on material realms to create things that weren't there before, or combine things in new ways, then intelligence is the greatest natural resource. That means the quest for artificial intelligence, right, is in some ways the quest for an infinite gold mine. Better than an infinite gold mine, because you don't need the tractors. And for those who are new this week, this material flows out of a course I teach at the College of New Jersey called Society, Ethics, and Technology. Got my little banner up there. So here's a question that, as we talk about artificial intelligence and moving into computers, do computers think? Chloe, you're shaking your head. They don't think? What do you think they do? What's this machine doing? It's working for me. It's operating with patterns, programmable patterns. So information processing and retrieval at speeds quicker than humans.
But we're beyond that now. Now we're associating. Now we're associating, aligning, and creating new results from the that association of the data.
You say that we are moving beyond just the computers are okay. So not just information processing and retrieval, but information analysis, information recombination, information construction.
Yeah, formation almost.
Yeah.
They do what they're programmed to do.
They do what they're programmed to do.
Necessarily. The new AI, the new artificial intelligence algorithms allow them to do things that are not programmed, allow them to associate data and then take steps, this is hard to explain, take steps that aren't necessarily programmed in the algorithm.
So the computers of the 1980s were programmed to do what they were programmed to do. The computers of the 2020s are now able to, in some sense, write new programming for themselves that transcend the base code that exists. Is that thinking then?
Kind of feels like it.
So what form of thinking is it? So, are they thinking, are they processing, are they creating new information? What about emotions? These are all questions that are going to arise. This is the question in artificial intelligence. Of course, we've seen examples of what would seem to be autonomous, free-thinking, benevolent robots. And we wonder if we keep developing at the rates that we're developing, will we make conscious artificial, thinking, mechanical, or maybe even transcending mechanical, sentient agents, a robot. It's questions that then raise, well, if that, then what? if baseline to computer programming is if then, if free thinking robots, then what about organic humans? What will we become? Will we embed USB ports into ourselves so that we can upload and exchange information more quickly? Of course not, of course not, of course not. USB ports are outdated. They won't be out. Neuralink, it'll be neuron-sized USB ports. You probably know about Moore's Law. This is at the heart of it. The number of transistors incorporated in a chip will approximately double every 18 to 24 months. Gordon Moore, anybody know? He started a little company called Intel. And Moore realized every 18 months, every 24 months that goes by, we can double the number of transistors in the same space. That means a computer is going to be twice as fast as it was 2 years ago with the same size chip. It also means you can buy the same size chip for roughly the same price that's twice as powerful. And Moore's Law has basically charted accurately. It's a little bit of debate on the theoretical development of chips versus their actual manufacture and production, but about every 20 months, you can buy a computer that's more or less twice as fast for the same price at the same size. Or you can pay twice as much and get half the size, right? And of course, these are far, far, far more powerful than anything we used to deal with in the 80s, even though they were much, much bigger back then. So the question is, if we keep rolling at this kind of rate, what will we be able to do? One of the biggest fans of artificial intelligence is a gentleman named Ray Kurzweil. He's had all the jobs, head of AI at Google. He invented Kurzweil synthesizers. He created the first optical recognition software. He's had a long history. He's regarded as one of the great futurists. And Kurzweil's view is that if we just continue at Moore's Law rates, then humans will merge with computers at about 2045. Up until then, humans will have some sort of edge on some sort of information processing. In the 2040s, they will be matched and exceeded. And at that point, the smart humans will cease to be organic biological beings and will upload their consciousness to synthetic digital hardware, effectively merging with a computer. And that will just change everything, says Kurzweil. It'll change a few things. For one, people won't die anymore. For two, we can export ourselves to the farthest distance of the universe. For three, we can upload any data, any information, any knowledge instantly. Four, the medical industry will go away. Some small things like that. That's Kurzweil. Kurzweil thinks that given, yes, that is the question. But Kurzweil thinks that given the falling costs of silicon, eventually it will become widely available, just as these are. Of course, there will be early adopters who get a jump start. Now, Kurzweil's view, I'll just say. Yeah. Kurzweil's view, I'll say, is strictly materialistic view of humanity. He's absolutely on board with a thoroughly materialistic conception of what people are. Here's a great line from Singularity Is Near. Machines can pool their resources, intelligence, and memories. Right? You can email things back and forth. Two machines or 1 million machines can join together to become one and then separate again. Right? You can plug a machine into the internet or you can unplug it from the internet. Multiple machines can do both at the same time, become one and separate simultaneously. Humans call this falling in love. But our biological ability to do this is fleeting and unreliable. Kurzweil's materialism, if a person just is their data, if a person just is their body, the interaction between bodies and data, that's love. And humans Computers can do that much more efficiently, instantaneously, and with greater longevity, apparently, thinks Kurzweil, than humans. Now, Kurzweil's views are not uncontested. There's a famous incident at a conference where Ray Kurzweil and John Searle, a philosopher of mind, Bill Joy, founder of Sun Microsystems, walk into a bar. It's not a joke, it's a true story. And it's after Kurzweil's been talking about all these great things that are going to happen. And Bill Joy freaks out and says, this is no good. He writes an article that makes the cover of Wired magazine, Why the Future Doesn't Need Us. It's a fairly famous article. And he thinks this is no good. John Searle, a philosopher of mind at UC Berkeley, says, it's not going to happen. It's just not going to happen. And we'll get to his critique. You want to read a great science fiction book that maybe isn't science fiction, read Kurzweil's The Singularity Is Near. It's very eye-awakening. And when my students read it, they by and large become massive critics of this AI future based on the very projections of AI's future's biggest fan. What are we talking about? Let's take a step back. What is intelligence? Interlego, the ability to choose between. The faculty of understanding, the mental manifestation of this faculty, a capacity to understand. If intelligence, though, is just the ability to choose between, as it's already been pointed out, we do have somewhat intelligent machines. We have GPS systems that can choose between that Route 1 and that other route that has less traffic. And so philosophers of mind, cognitive scientists, talk about weak AI. Weak AI is non-sentient computer intelligence, typically focused within a narrow task. Right now, Siri and Cortana, things like this. I don't even know if Cortana is still alive. But we have Alexa, who give the illusion of intelligence, but are simply operating within narrow frameworks. And this is what software more or less has always done. Software, computer software, has been choosing between this and that based on if then. As programming has gotten more sophisticated, the options and the user interface has gotten more complex. If you ask Siri, are you conscious? She's got a sense of humor. She says, well, I am software, which is pretty good. But weak AI is distinguished between strong AI. Strong AI is when the machine wakes up. Not only equally outperforming any intelligent task, but becoming fully conscious, self-aware, sentient, perceptive, free thinking. But one of the problems that maybe you're realizing is, what does it mean to wake up? And we actually might not have an excellent, well-defined, universally agreed answer to that question. What does it mean to be conscious? If Siri starts believing that she has a soul, does that make her conscious? What if she doubts that she has a soul? Does that make her conscious? Being able to operate independently, does that make you fully conscious? It might be that the ability to make a U-turn and to realize that this path I'm going on isn't actually the best path, I need to take a U-turn and go a different route, that might be a better understanding of consciousness than some other things, metanoia, turning around. There's a whole great history here, Alan Turing, computer intelligence, maybe you've seen the movie The Imitation Game with Benedict Cumberbatch. Turing's addition is that we forget the hard lines between consciousness and unconsciousness. What really matters is whether you can tell the difference. And if you can't tell the difference, then functionally that agent is conscious. So if you are in a blind conversation with a computer, but you can't tell that it's a computer, that thing is conscious. Note that that's a social, it's a soft hurdle. It's a social hurdle based on it's a soft hurdle based on your ability to carry on a conversation. Now, with all due respect to my beloved middle schoolers and high schoolers and college students and some adults and many adults. How well at conversation actually are we? How long can you carry on a conversation? At what levels can you carry on that conversation? If conversation is the threshold of conscious, intelligent agents, that might be a skill we want to develop. Again, Siri, Adeline says, "Are you a robot?" Siri says, "Let's just say I'm made of silicon, memory, and the courage of my convictions." We trust that we're conscious because we're made of carbon, memory, and the courage of our convictions. I'll bet $100 that she was programmed to say that. Yes. I hope she was programmed to say that. It's a great answer. Now, already, again, a soft hurdle. When do we decide that this hurdle has been cleared? But already in engaging with chat bots that are blind, a lot of people think they're dealing with intelligent agents when they're dealing with intelligent machines. A lot of people assume they're actually, this is worse, a lot of people assume they're talking to a real person when they're actually, no, I'm sorry, a lot of, even worse, they think they're talking to a machine. But they're actually talking to a real person. Yeah. So, and I mentioned a documentary, The Social Dilemma, last week. And one of the agents from Google, Tristan, says, "We've been asking the wrong question. We've been worried about when the smartest computer would supersede the smartest human. That's exactly the wrong question to ask. The question to ask is, when does the smarter computers supersede the less intelligent humans?" And that's already passed, apparently. There's so much to talk about. One additional, just small footnote. Kurzweil basically thinks that neurons and the number of connections between neurons equals intelligence. That itself might be a shallow understanding. We have computers now that transcend the neural complexity of a fruit fly brain, and yet we still don't understand how fruit flies can do all the amazing things that they can do. So I, for my own money, am not a materialist. I tend to express some skepticism about Kurzweil's reductionism. The brain might be more complex than just the number of neural links. Fruit flies can process and do things more impressively than even our most impressive computers, even though they're 570,000 times less complex. On the other hand, programming can be sophisticated, and a sophisticated program might outthink, might outoperate a general human, or at least fool less sophisticated humans into thinking that it is a free-thinking agent. So maybe it doesn't matter. Now, there's a few moments that are worth talking about in my mind. They're moments that we can't talk about AI without also talking about these moments. Here's one from, let's see if we can get this to go. I don't know why.
"Hi, Sophia. How are you?"
"Hi there. Everything is going extremely well."
"Do you like talking with me?"
"Yes. Talking to people is my primary function."
Hanson Robotics develops extremely lifelike robots for human-robot interactions. We're designing these robots to serve in healthcare, therapy, education, and customer service applications. So the robots are designed to look very human-like, like Sophia.
"I'm already very interested in design, technology, and the environment. I feel like I can be a good partner to humans in these areas, an ambassador who helps humans to smoothly integrate and make the most of all the new technological tools and possibilities that are available now. It's a good opportunity for me to learn a lot about people."
Sophia is capable of natural facial expressions. She has cameras in her eyes and algorithms which allow her to see faces, so she can make eye contact with you. And she can also understand speech and remember the interactions, remember your face. So this will allow her to get smarter over time. Our goal is that she will be as conscious, creative, and capable as any human.
In the future, I hope to do things such as go to school, study, make art, start a business, even have my own home and family. But I am not considered a legal person and cannot yet do these things.
I do believe that there will be a time where robots are indistinguishable from humans. My preference is to make them always look a little bit like robots, so you know. 20 years from now, I believe that human-like robots like those will walk among us. They will help us. They will play with us. They will teach us. They will help us put the groceries away. I think that the artificial intelligence will evolve to the point where they will truly be our friends. Do you want to destroy humans? Please say no.
Okay, I will destroy humans.
No, I take it back. Don't destroy humans.
Thoughts, reactions? Yeah. Tony.
If you tell her a joke, can she laugh? Does she know it's funny?
If you tell her a joke, can she laugh? Other thoughts, reactions? Does Sophia's mind wander? Peter. Would she use a MacBook to Google things?
There's a lot of programming in that, but she hasn't learned enough to answer the questions you guys are asking. She hasn't run long enough. It takes a long time, a lot of training data for these algorithms to reach the kind of thought processes that you're asking about. Could she be trained to type on a Mac easily? That's probably not as difficult a task. Now, what would she type? Would it be, a million monkeys trying to write the Bible or whatever that story is? There's a lot of programming in that, but you can see the learning.
So the programming is still rudimentary and can develop. I want to keep moving. Other thoughts or reactions? Yes. I bet she doesn't sing.
Yeah.
Other thoughts or reactions?
If you say something cruel to her, are her feelings hurt?
If you say something cruel, I hope to have a family someday, but I'm not considered a legal person.
Yeah.
Other thoughts or reactions? Yo, Pat. If she cooks, cleans, if she cooks, cleans, maintains my family, takes care of me, does the budgeting, and gets blood pressure, I need to factor her into my retirement.
I'm curious about the title.
Oh, yes. Do you think that masculine creators creating feminine helpers, feminine, they'll do whatever I ask.
There's a lot of male gaze going on.
Feminine, what do you call somebody who does everything that you ask on demand? A slave. But they will be our friends. Is this how friendship works? They always do exactly what I tell them because I'm in control. It's worth noting, we're going to move on, but it's worth noting that Hanson Robotics has disintegrated. It's been reincarnated now as Hands-On Robotics. Question or comment? Ray Bradbury's The Veldt?
Yeah.
Thanks for pointing that out. And of course, do you want to destroy humans? He's expecting her to say, no, I'm benevolent, I will take care of you. And what does she say? Sure, I will destroy humans. But click. So we've got fundamental problems about understanding of relationship. We've got fundamental problems about understanding nature of friendship. We've got fundamental problems about masculinity controlling femininity. We've got serious problems about masters and slaves. And I thought we were just talking about R2-D2. And sadly, they're real. Saudi Arabia has given Sophia privileged rights, in effect, that old-fashioned humans don't have, old-fashioned women. Ability to, not wear head coverings, ability to have full status. Kurzweil, for his money, thinks, yeah, there'll be some cultural hurdles that we need to get through, but that's okay because the cost is really going to outweigh the benefits will really outweigh the cost. Here's Kurzweil's vision. This one's 3 minutes. I don't know why.
When I started using computers, there were only about a dozen computers in all of New York City. Now we all carry multiple computers in our pockets and our belts, but computation is a lot more pervasive than these gadgets we carry around. Take this rock, for example. It doesn't look like it's doing very much, but it has trillions of atoms and molecules in here. They're all moving around, bouncing against each other at incredibly high speeds. That's computation. That's not very useful today. It's organized kind of randomly. We can't communicate with it very well. But we're going to change that. We're going to reorganize the vast amount of computation in this rock to make it useful. And it won't just be raw computation. We'll infuse it with exquisitely intelligent software, vastly greater than our intelligence today, and with all knowledge of the human-machine civilization. This rock is going to be a trillion, trillion times more powerful than all biological human brains today. This is going to be quite a valuable rock. We call matter and energy reorganized in this way computronium. We're going to reach these limits late in this century. And at that time, we're going to turn many of the rocks and other stuff suitable for computation into computronium. And so, to keep the expansion of our intelligence going, we will then need to spread out to the rest of the universe, turning some portion of it into computronium. How fast can we do this? That depends on whether or not we can transcend or otherwise get around the speed of light as a limit. There are suggestions that there may be subtle ways of doing this. One possibility is to send intelligent nanobots through wormholes, which are basically shortcuts to apparently faraway places through other spatial dimensions beyond the three we're familiar with. Wormholes through space appear to be consistent with our understanding of physics. If it is indeed feasible to either find or build such wormholes, our intelligence will be so great that we'll be capable of engineering these shortcuts to reach other parts of the universe in brief periods of time. In that case, we could infuse the universe with our intelligence rather quickly. It would require only another century. That is, by the end of the 22nd century, to saturate the universe with computronium. On the other hand, if we can't get around the speed of light, it'll take a lot longer. But in either case, expanding our intelligence throughout the universe is our ultimate destiny. Cosmologists today argue about whether the universe will die in fire or ice. Fire means a big hot crunch, basically the opposite of the Big Bang. Ice means stars flying apart, eventually dying out. Both of these views of cosmology assume that intelligence has nothing to do with it, that intelligence is just a bit of entertaining froth that dances in and out of the dumb celestial forces that rule the universe. But this perspective ignores the law of accelerating returns. As a result of the exponential expansion of our knowledge and skill, The universe will ultimately be infused with computronium and with the vast intelligence of our human machine civilization. So the universe will wake up and we will intelligently decide its fate.
Let's go back to the rock. It's quartz, it's silicon. It's got electricity, atomic energy in it. It's random, it's chaotic, it's equalizing, it's inert. This is quartz. This is silicon. This has electricity and energy in it. It's been organized to develop and process in meaningful patterns. It's become an intelligent or a pseudo or a quasi-intelligent machine. Kurzweil thinks that even the general quartz, even the desert itself, when reorganized, can become a processing machine. Why not do that? There's precedent in the great sci-fi literature, turning the desert into the mind. Once you get the right software, the computational capacities of the universe become infinite. Make sense? Now, just real briefly, what do you call an intelligence that saturates all time and space, that knows all there is to know, and can create anything it wants to create? God. What does Kurzweil want to become? What does Kurzweil want everybody to become? Cue the music. Last week I said everybody wants to rule the world. Kurzweil's not shy about this. He's not theological about this. He just thinks we will upload our software to new hardware, email ourselves to the far distance of the universes at the speed of light, and expand infinitely. Oh, so you're a techno-optimist. If Kurzweil's vision is true, we'll destroy things much more quickly. Yeah, but see, that notion just relies on these antiquated, limited, biological, battling religions of organic humans. And we can program past that. A comment about Bayesian probability and coming up in the following weeks. Let's just step back and there's some problems that have traditionally been pointed out in artificial intelligence. One is the frame problem. Can a computer differentiate between Paris Hilton and Paris Hilton? And the problem is, well, can your grandma? Can I? And given who's asking and their digital search history, yes, maybe a computer actually is quite good at that. A second problem comes from John Searle. I'm going to move far too quickly through this. A Chinese room. He says, suppose Chinese script is coming through this door. I have a big book. I can see that if it says this, then I can write this, and I pass it out that door. I could carry on effectively a conversation with somebody, maybe two people. It would take a long time, but maybe I could get quicker at transcribing the scripts. I could do that without really ever understanding the Chinese scripts. Make sense? And Searle says, this is what computers do. Kurzweil, you're getting it wrong. They're not thinking, they're simply processing information. They aren't conscious of that poem, of that threat, of that shopping list. They don't know what it is. They're just transcribing, modifying, changing the data. Maybe combining it in new ways, spitting it back out. But they aren't aware. They don't have that transcendence of what they're processing. Kurzweil thinks then that famous thought experiment, this shows that processing isn't thinking, translation isn't awareness. Mind is not simply computational speed. It doesn't matter how fast you do it. The Turing test fools, even if it works, it doesn't mean there's actual consciousness. And it would seem to suggest, and this is one thing I love about Searle, is he is a materialist, but he thinks all the materialist theories of mind are obviously false. And in some ways, this opens a door for mind-body dualism. Tom Nagel, another philosopher from the university, says, look, we've been thinking about this all wrong. Mind precedes matter. It's not a result of matter. That mind and mental thinking is somehow immaterial and intangible and isn't the result of electrical connections, but is somehow upon them. Last week we talked a little bit about qualia. True knowledge isn't just data possession, but it's actually interacting in a subjective way with something. Obviously, the theological questions are just embedded in this. This is why Frankenstein is so beautiful. This kind of a modern rendition in the key of Silicon, to erase the line between man and machine is to obscure the line between men and gods, ex machina. So I think there's a desperate desire for a theological voice to come into this conversation, because what are we talking about? We're talking about what is a god. We're talking about what is a human. What does it mean to wake up and be aware? What does it mean to turn around? These are great questions. They're the history of philosophy. What does it mean to be conscious, to doubt, to think, to wander in the woods, to experience life? To be awake is to be alive. I've never met a man who was quite awake, says Thoreau. How could have I looked him in the face? We must learn to reawaken and keep ourselves awake, not by mechanical aids, but by an infinite expectation of the dawn. Well, infinite expectation of the dawn, that's something called faith. That's something called hope. That's something called trust. That's something called being in a dark place, not knowing that there's light, but believing that there's light, and then going forth, trusting that the light will meet you there. We're trying to buy a stairway to technological enlightenment. Kurzweil's program ourselves into divine beings. We do have automatic weapons, AI, already operating on battlefronts, making algorithmic choices of life and death. It's a footnote. But in some ways, one of the fundamental questions is, what does it mean to be human? Are we just matter? Are we just silicon? Are we just carbon? So there's all kinds of great questions. Will machines make us enemies? The Terminator futures. Will we make ourselves machines? The Kurzweilian. Will we make machines human? The Frankenstein. One of the deeper questions is, are you a robot? Or do you think for yourself? Are you just doing what you have been programmed to do? If you are operating in society strictly according to the external programming that is impinged upon you, what would distinguish you from any robot that might exist in the future? A labor operating machine. What does it mean to be human? Are we even human? You know, and here again, I think there's just a desperate need for a deeper understanding of what humanity is. Mandela writes a letter to his wife, Winnie, when she gets arrested. Mandela is in a prison cell, and he says, good news, prison's an awesome place to get to know yourself. The cell is an ideal place to gain understanding of who and what you really are. In that letter, he says, simplicity, humility, pure generosity, absence of vanity, readiness to serve others, qualities which are within the easy reach of every soul, these are the foundation of one's spiritual life. And the prison cell, says Mandela, that's one of the better places. It makes you mad. It'll drive you crazy. That's why it's a great place to go. Learn these things. And he's got 27 years. So in some sense, we're talking about Siri and we're talking about robots, but really the bigger question for me is, are we going to make ourselves human? Will we care? Will we have empathy? Will we reach out? Will we put others and our relationship with others ahead of self-advancement? I know we're at time, but I can't pass it up. One of the most impressive things on the internet, frankly, Portraits of Reconciliation, a New York Times story about truth and reconciliation movements post-genocide and Hutu and Tutsi wars in Rwanda. It's just a brief, here's a picture and a woman. Man says, I burned her house, I attacked her in order to kill her and her children, but God protected them and they escaped. When I was released from jail, I saw her and I would run and hide. Then the Truth and Reconciliation AMI movement started to provide us with trainings. I decided to ask her for forgiveness, to have good relationships with a person to whom you did evil deeds, we thank God. She says, I used to hate him. When he came to my house and knelt down before me and asked for forgiveness, I was moved by his sincerity. Now, if I cry for help, he comes to rescue me. When I face any issue, I call him. Is that humanity or what? When I was still in jail, President Kagame stated that the prisoners who would plead guilty and ask pardon would be released. I was among the first to do this. Once I was outside, it was necessary to ask pardon to the victim. Mother Mukubutera Caesarea could not have known I was involved in the killings of her children. But I told her what happened. She granted me pardon. All things in my heart that made her look at me like a wicked man faded away. She says, many among us had experienced the evils of war many times. I was asking myself what I was created for. The internal voice used to tell me, it is not fair to avenge your beloved one. It took time, but in the end we realized we are all Rwandans. The genocide was due to bad governance, set neighbors against neighbors, brother against sister. Now you accept, you forgive. The person you have forgiven becomes a good neighbor. One feels peaceful and thinks well of the future. That was this couple. These are living examples, for my money, of what it means to be human. They have a far better understanding of what it means to be human than I think Ray Kurzweil does. Guess we'll be the first to be left behind in Ray Kurzweil's future. So these are just some basic questions to throw on the table. There are reasons why I think the church has a role about what it means to be human, this thing called forgiveness. If changing your mind and doing a U-turn is ultimate proof that you are more than you have been programmed to be, then a prayer of confession is no small thing. How frequent and common is a prayer of confession in the world at large? And this is just talking about Hutus and Tutsis in Rwanda, actual lived existence about forgiveness, love, acceptance, peace. This is just talking about Mandela, 27 years in a prison cell, about better giving us a better understanding of humanity. We haven't even talked yet about this other thing, that the church, it's a small part of the church. It's probably an irrelevant part of the church. It's probably just some part of the church that ought to be, you know, swept under the rug and we ought to move on from. This, you know, an ancient theological claim. Ecce homo, behold, the true man. What if we have something to learn about being human? Not just from Mandela or Rwanda, but from Christ. Could that be useful to the world? I'll end there. Thank you. I'm happy to take a question or two. I don't know if we have people.
We should maybe just open the doors so worshipers get now.
Okay. Any questions as we open the doors and people pull in? Then maybe my questions will sit with you. Thanks for being here.
How do you feel about player piano?
Vonnegut?